Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon. Named the most innovative investment bank for climate change and sustainability by The Banker. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America North America. Member FDIC.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have someone I've actually followed his work for many, many years. His name is John Roque, and he is a technician extraordinaire. He is one of those technical folks that other technicians talk about in hushed and reverent tones. You will find him to be straightforward, humble, blunt in how he describes what he does. If you're looking for somebody who has worked for George Soros and worked for other storied shops to be arrogant and suffer from a big head, this is not the guy that exhibits any of that. He is someone who not only has worked at places like Lehman Brothers and Soros Funds Management, but has constantly improved his craft and constantly raised his own skill level and reputation within the industry, and is really insightful and really knowledgeable about just about everything related to technical analysis. So if you are at all interested in charts and in investing and trading, if you want to know how some of the sausage is made on the technical side, you can't do much better than John Roque. So with no further ado, my conversation with John Roque.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My special guest today is John Roque. He is a technician extraordinaire and spent the first 21 years of his career as a sell-side analyst before being recruited to the buy side by George Soros and his hedge fund. He spent 5 years at Lehman Brothers, about a decade at Natexis Bleichschroeder, a few years at WJB Capital before he ended up with Soros. He is now, let's call it, managing director and chief market strategist at a Soros-seeded hedge fund called Keysquare Capital Management. John Roque, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thanks, Barry. Pleasure to be here.
So you and I know each other for some time. I was always a fan of getting your research. Let's talk a little bit about what you do and how you do it. You were on the sell side for over 20 years. Most of what I know about your work is that you were a technician, a chart reader. Was that always your career? Did you start out as a technician, or how did you eventually evolved to that?
I finished my MBA at Fordham University in 1990. And
Now called the Gabelli School, is that right?
And like anybody else who probably graduated either with an undergraduate degree in the mid-80s or an MBA in the early 90s, you probably wanted to work on Wall Street. I found it difficult going. I walked around my resume back then, and there was very little security in the building, so you were able to go in and deliver
just
your resume.
Pre-9/11, you walk in wherever you wanted.
It was a great time. I got to meet the Sanford Bernstein just by doing that, just happenstance. And there was an ad in the paper, like guys of our age used to do. We used to look in the New York Times
newspaper,
on a Sunday.
Right. What's in the classifieds?
Correct. And there was a job for a an analyst position at Safian Investment Research in White Plains,
sure.
New York.
That's way back when.
It certainly is. Ken Safian and his former partner, Ken Smilin, were top analysts on the street in the 70s, and he ran a boutique investment shop. I applied to him. I sent a resume, a cover letter, and a copy of my thesis paper, and Ken was kind enough to hire me.
So you come out of school with an MBA. You start working for a boutique research firm. How does that morph into a CMT? How does that morph into technicals?
Well, to be honest, I'm not a CMT, but I'll tell you how it morphed into technicals. So Ken Safian did a ton of economic work, but he also did a ton of technical work.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he had a process in the late 60s, 70s called the dual market principle, mm-hmm. where he saw the market as being delineated between growth stocks and cyclical stocks at different points in an economic cycle. So he did a lot of cutting edge technical work, and he allowed me to join in, to maintain and create and keep economic indicators as well as technical indicators. And I think it was sort of, you know, he opened the kimono, for lack of a better phrase, and I got to see a lot of things. I became very interested.
Mm-hmm. So how did that lead to charting?
Well, every single day, I know this will sound really old school or dinosaur-like, at the end of the day, I would print out 90 prices from my Bloomberg. There was one mm-hmm. Bloomberg in the whole shop.
Right.
And I would graph using pencil and a ruler and graph paper the high, low, and closing prices for 90 stocks for every day for 4 years.
You are not the only technician who've said that. We've had from Jeff DeGraff to Luis Yamada to Paul Desmond to Ralph Acampora. It seems that this generation and the previous generation of people all graphed by hand in the early days.
Well, that was the only way to do it when it really came down to it. The Mansfield charts used to be delivered on a Saturday morning to your house, but they were through Thursday prices.
Explain what that is. That's people, so youngins aren't going to know what that is.
Mansfield was out of New Jersey. I think it was Jersey City, and it was a subscription pricing. And you sent in your check, and you would get New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ, Amex charts.
Like weekly a charts. Giant book would show up.
It was
up.
Actually, it was almost like loose leaf paper.
Right, that you could update stuff
right,
on
you
a
would flip
basis.
Through it. And they would deliver it on a Saturday
three-ring
morning.
Three-ring binder, is that right?
You could put it in a binder, but I would end up flipping through it, throwing out the ones I didn't want, keeping the ones I did, and it came in cellophane paper, and some guy would drop it off like your newspaper on a Saturday morning on your front stoop.
If I recall, they were located in Jersey City, so they could get
That's
to
right.
New York City people quickly,
yeah.
as opposed to where, you know, being on the other side of the country.
That's
they had
correct.
To print it. And then drop it off in the
yeah,
region.
Yeah, it was an excellent service. The charts were easy to read, and nobody had this sort of stuff at your home, right? Bloomberg
right.
coming into your house was
unthinkable.
Unthinkable.
You didn't
then.
Have the internet. You didn't have the computing power.
Right.
You didn't have anything.
Right. So, and then Investors Business Daily, you could buy chart books from them. They would also be delivered on a weekly basis. That sort of took Mansfield and upgraded a little bit.
Uh-huh.
But those were the only ways to do it, really.
That was it. So at what point did you say, gee, I'm a pure technician. I'm not really looking at a whole lot else besides technicals?
Well, when at Safi and Investment Research, I thought that doing it from a technical point of view allowed me to see a lot of things pretty darn quickly mm-hmm. rather than focusing on one thing and being in depth. And I liked the overview aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, although my thesis paper was on Connor peripherals and it was using, you know, financial statement analysis, I was sort of wholly technical, and I've been wholly technical since.
Ever since. So let's talk about technicals a little bit. What is it that charts actually measure, and why does that work?
I think charts measure the dynamic between buyers and sellers, supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, you're a longtime market participant, and you might say to me, well, John, for every buyer, there has to be a seller. And I'd say, I agree 100%. But technical analysis tells us who's more aggressive, the buyer or the seller. And I think that's a very important concept. So we might say, yeah, for every buyer, there's a seller. Yeah, but if I'm the buyer and I want to pay more for it because I really think it's going up, that is information that is readily available
right.
in
there
the
may,
chart.
There may not be a buyer or seller at every price.
That's correct.
So that's what determines.
That's correct. I mean, if you think about it this way, you know, you might say to me that I'm buying this stock because it's cheap, and I'll say that's true, but it doesn't win because it stays cheap,
right?
It wins because by definition, it gets momentum and gets less cheap.
Right.
And
just because something's cheap doesn't mean it's not going to get cheaper.
That's correct.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is John Roque. He is the master technician who previously was working with George Soros. Now he works at a Soros-backed hedge fund called Key Square Capital. Let's talk a little about technicals. And I'm assuming the audience is fairly layperson. Explain exactly what technical analysis is for the layperson.
I think technical analysis is about trend.
Mm-hmm.
It is not about trading. There are some people who are really good at trading, but I'm not. And I think in the advent of machines at hyper speed,
right.
The less we talk about trading, the likely we're going to be more successful at our trend following discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So I think technicals are about trend. Trend is the least, in my opinion, understood investment concept, however, because it's very hard to identify.
So let's go into trends a little bit. I was always taught a trend is you can, as if you can draw a straight line across 3 points, you have a trend. Is that oversimplifying?
No, I don't think it's oversimplifying it at all. But how many people do you know in a business are willing to stick with that trend until it's finished?
As long as it's going in the same right direction, yeah. Why would
Richard
you...
Russell said the most difficult thing in the business is to stick with a bull market the entire way through. And the second most difficult thing in the business is to stay out of a bear market the entire way through. So I'd say trend following is pretty darn difficult. Richard Russell was pretty ahead of the game with that one.
So what do you think are some of the bigger misconceptions about charts and technical analysis?
I think the misconceptions are that technical analysis sees all. It may be that it does, but no technical analyst sees all.
That's intriguing. So explain the difference between everything being there in price and not being able to recognize that from the charts.
Well, just to give you an example, when I was at Soros Fund Management, I surveyed, let's call it 12 technical types every week. And I asked them buy, sell, or neutral on a 10 roster item list.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be surprised how many people came back with items that were different from the person who had just responded. So you could have 12 people responding every week and there would be no quorum as to what, let's say, item A is doing. And so my former partner, Steve Chauvin at Lehman, was fond of saying, it's the singer, not the song.
Okay, so naturally leads to the next question. How much of this is science and how much of this is art and somewhat subjective? I get the sense you're implying it's a little of both.
I think it's a lot of both. I'm fond of this book that I read early in my career. It's not an investment book. It's a poker book. It's called Shut Up and Deal, and it's written by a guy named Jesse May.
Okay.
And I'm going to paraphrase it, and I'm going to cuff the comment. But in the book, he said, when you play poker, everybody wants to master the rules, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you raise, when you fold, right? That's important. He said, but winning at poker is about mastering the luck. And I think that's appropriate for our business as well. So I would apply that to your question and say, it's a little bit of science. It's a little bit of poetry. It's all those things put together.
So how do we master luck? I always assume luck is to some degree random, although we've all heard the expression, luck is where preparation meets opportunity.
Or Branch Rickey said luck is the residue of design, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Right.
All those things are appropriate. I think it is listening to the message in the charts
mm-hmm.
and not putting your biases into what you think it's telling you.
How hard is it to keep your biases?
I think it's
out
very hard, which is why sometimes when I was on the sell side, I would send out charts that I would reports entitled mystery charts. And I would say the first person who gets this question right, I'll buy him lunch next time I'm in their town.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be surprised how many people would be quick to respond. And I would put the chart, I would put the technical characteristics of it, but I would take the title off of it.
Uh-huh.
And I think when people saw it without the title, they made a more objective decision than when they saw it with the title. And I think that's a good way to think about it.
So I have a variation of that, which I call the indicator, that when you would talk about a name with somebody who is on the buy side, when you were on the sell side, if you would bring up the name and 3 out of 4 people go, I can't touch that. That's a piece of junk. Hey, well, guess what? If everybody thinks that, it's probably already in the price. And it a little bit of momentum, and you have plenty of upside there. That's funny that you did it by just pulling the names off of
yeah.
it. So when you revealed the names, what was generally the response to people who said, this chart looks great, I'm excited about this?
I think some people who had the objectivity
mm-hmm.
Would say, oh, well, okay, I don't care what the name is. The darn chart looks good. It must be that the story's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And other people might have been a little bit dismissive of it. Oh, yeah, okay, but I'm not interested. But I think the
exercise... But they were before you told
correct.
Them the name.
Yeah, and I think the exercise sort of was a good exercise to allow them to say, hey, there's something there, and if we remove our biases, we can actually pick up some important information.
So tell me a little bit about your process. When you were on the sell side, what did your daily research consist of, and how did that change once you moved to the buy side?
So my process includes trying, and I'm going to emphasize the word trying, to monitor or pay attention to all sorts of traded prices, mm-hmm. bonds, their corresponding yields, commodities, currencies, sectors, indexes, stocks, across all sorts of time zones.
Mm-hmm.
And I built some screening tools, some scoring mechanisms that help me do that. And like any other technical person or any other chart person, I look at a ton of charts. Mm-hmm. And I've taken that discipline from the sell side and I've tried to apply it on the buy side.
So now that you're on the buy side, is your process very much different other than having to travel for work and sell a product? Short of that, is the research process still the same?
I'd say it's pretty much the same.
That's really quite interesting. One of the things I loved about when you were on the sell side, your written product, you would, similar to Ed Hyman, who's an economist, take a chart and mark it up by hand. First, where did that idea come from?
Well, I mean, you prefaced it. I mean, Ed Hyman taught us all that annotating charts simply and clearly really goes a long way to making your research more palatable to the people who are paying for it. So he's the godfather of it, to tell the truth.
And you answered the second question, which is, what's the purpose of handwriting?
I think
on
it's
chart?
Just so people become familiar with you and your research. And I think when people become familiar with you, there's a trust aspect that grows. And you know, for somebody who was formerly selling research, I think that's a really important concept to building a business. You have to develop a trust aspect with the people who are going to pay you commission dollars for your research.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is John Roque, and you have been working for the past couple of years for Soros Fund Management, which is George Soros's hedge fund. What is it like working at such a storied firm like that?
I'm going to try to create a metaphor. I think it was, to me, it was sort of like being able to play basketball for University of North Carolina Tar Heels when Dean Smith was the coach.
Okay.
Or playing basketball for the UCLA Bruins when John Wooden was the coach. It was sort of PhD macro.
Across the board.
Just a true honor for me to have been there.
So we all recall the story, I think it was told by Soros' son, that when his back started aching, started bothering him, he basically had to sell something to make the pain go away. Any truth to that?
Well, I read the same story, but I would probably say that was akin to a very strong intuition.
Mm-hmm.
And I think after being in the business for a long period of time, we all develop intuitions that we listen to, you know, with a very attentive ear.
So he's known as a big macro trader, famously bet against the pound and a number of other really large macro bets. How does a technician fit into a shop like that, that at least publicly seems to be so macro event driven?
I actually think it's a natural that macro and technical analysis are complementary, in my opinion. One of my favorite books in the business is a book entitled More Money Than God, which is written by Sebastian Mallaby.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, you read about all of the storied hedge funds and about guys in our business whose faces are on the Mount Rushmore of investing, and you realize just how important technical analysis was or is to their process. I think it's just a natural, and it wasn't a shock to me.
Not a shock at all.
It wasn't a shock to me.
Pretty consistent. It's funny, Mallaby just put out the book on Greenspan, which I haven't gotten to.
I haven't either.
But I have More Money Than God at home, and it's one of those things that's on my short list that I'm going to get to. So you move from the sell side to the buy side. When you were on the sell side, you were very much a public figure. You used to do conferences and television and everything. You go to the buy side, and it's radio silence.
Yes.
What was that transition like? Was it relaxing to kind of get out of the public eye, or did you miss a little of the back and forth, give and take?
Well, I got to tell you, for 20 years of doing shows like this with people like you.
There are no shows like this.
Very nice. or traveling to market my product was a great thrill. Being on Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser was a bucket list kind of thing to do. But I'm equally happy being on the buy side, and I put all my energy and emphasis into putting out product that I think is going to help Key Square Capital Management.
So when you say put out product, I'm assuming there's an investment committee, you're participating in that, or there's some dialogue back and forth. How is advising on deploying capital different than selling a commission transaction? Or is it not different?
I think an idea is an idea irrespective of which side of the business you're on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the person that you're speaking to, and I happen to be speaking to a person who is intellectually open. His name is Scott Bessent, and always willing to listen to an idea. And because he's like that, it gives me confidence to continue to present those ideas. It's sort of like when you're on the sell side and you have a client that you get along with really well, you'll call that person all the time and you'll show that person all of your ideas mm-hmm. because they're willing recipients of those ideas. And some of your clients, when you're being on the sell side, were probably less
receptive.
Receptive is a good word. And so I've been lucky that the gentleman I'm working with now and have worked with over 5 years is receptive to ideas and intellectually open and willing to listen to my imagination.
So Scott Bessin, if I recall the name correctly, formerly CIO of Soros Fund Management, is that right?
That's correct.
And I also recall you saying he's the person who recruited you to work it with Soros.
That's exactly right.
So I have to assume that he is a heavy hitter running Soros's money. That's a fairly substantial fund. Is it the same sort of investment process at Key Square that it was at Soros, or is it a little different? You know, Soros is now mostly running his own money, if I'm correct. Mostly?
It's a family office.
Family office, as opposed to Key Square, where it's a lot of outside investors.
I think it is a macro-focused fund, and from that point of view, it has a similar focus.
My special guest today is John Roque. He is a technician currently working for Key Square Capital, which is a hedge fund seeded by George Soros. He worked on the sell side at a number of storied shops, including Lehman Brothers, for many years before going to work at Soros Fund Management. Let's talk a little bit about your approach. You do some things that I find to be really interesting that I don't see a lot of other people doing. For example, I've noticed how you calculate market cap of sector and then put it against the S&P 500. Tell us what that actually accomplishes and how you began doing that sort of analysis.
Okay, so all credit goes to a former client of mine by the name of Bob Rossetti, who was at Morgan Stanley Asset Management at the time, Morgan Stanley Capital Management. And he was a very technically focused guy,
mm-hmm.
Although a fundamental guy, but very technically focused. And one day he said to me, you know, I have some data that might be of interest to you. And he shared the data with me, which was sort of like giving me the keys to the kingdom.
How long ago was this?
Gosh, this was in the 90s.
Really?
Yeah, this was in the mid-90s.
So he says, here's the data showing, take the cap of each sector
yeah.
versus the total capitalization.
Correct,
of...
and do it on a relative market cap basis. That's right, mm-hmm. as a percent of the S&P. And I thought that was, I mean, he really opened my eyes to a section of the market that I was formerly not aware of, or how to use it in an analytical sense. And so I used it to great success, I'll say polite, to some success in two particular instances after that. One of them was as tech was making its apotheosis in late 99 and early 2000, and tech had grown to be about a third of the weight of the S&P 500.
Really? That's astonishing.
On a market relative market cap basis. And when it first cracked, I knew that Icarus had flown too close to the sun. And I knew that we were going to have a very painful bear market, and it was going to be more than a flesh wound, to paraphrase the Black Knight from Monty Python. and so I thought tech was going to get destroyed. And
what's down 80% amongst friends?
Well, and then in 2006, the relative market cap of financials grew to be more than 20% of the S&P 500, cracked at 22.3% at 22.5%. And I thought that that was going to be really bad because the financials... Not only did they have a big market cap, but even a technical guy would probably tell you how important they are to the economy.
To say the least. Sure.
And so I used that analysis to some success at both of those important periods.
So when you're looking at the cap relative to the broader index, what is that actually informing you other than those instances where you're at wild extremes? Or is that what you're looking for?
I'm looking for wild extremes, but I'm also looking for trends within those relative market caps,
mm-hmm.
right? Relative market cap is sort of a way of saying relative price.
Mm-hmm.
And if relative market cap continues to steadily move higher, then I'm going to figure that the trend for that sector is intact, firm, strong, and advancing. And I should be looking for stocks in that sector that I should be biased toward the upside with.
All right, so let's say you find a particular sector you like. How do you keep drilling down from there? Do you look at subsectors? Do you go right to companies? You pick a random sector that The trend is long, strong, firm. Where do you go from there?
I want to find the biggest cap companies in that particular sector.
Really? Why is that?
Because for a fund of some size, it doesn't make much sense to focus on stocks of smaller market capitalizations because it's very difficult to move the needle.
Right.
So I want to focus on the largest market cap stocks in a sector that is trending because I think I can get the better, longer dated performance from those stocks.
Right. You can't get enough of a small cap for a substantial fund to make any sort of difference.
That's right.
And the big stocks are always very liquid, and I'm sure you could buy as much of that as you want.
And if you needed to take yourself out of a position, right, you could do it with little dislocation.
Huh. That's very interesting. So of late, you've been somewhat bearish on the financials. How important are financials to the S&P and to the economy? Can we really have a bull market without the financials participating?
Well, so I'm always going through my process and always going through the now 11 S&P economic sectors. Financials are one of the 11. There were formerly 10. S&P broke out REITs from the financials. Now they're 11. And I noticed that during a 22-month period from December 2014 through October 2016, the financials had gone through four important setbacks: 9%, 14, 22, and 10.5%. And they had underperformed the S&P during that 22-month period. So to have them as an underweight or to be cautious on them probably wasn't such a bad idea. Mm-hmm. In addition, at the same time, European banks and Japanese banks were terrible. Very poor.
Awful.
Right. And the only bank group that was doing pretty well of G7 markets was Canada. So to have avoided financials for that period wasn't such a bad idea. It was only in the last week where you really had a tremendous performance.
Post-election.
That's correct.
But, you know, when you have a geopolitical surprise like that, that isn't necessarily going to be reflected in analysis beforehand. Everybody's playing
because
the
it was just
probability.
So darn sudden. Right.
Right. And so now how do you look at financials today? Has the recent move changed your mind, or does it look like a temporary spasm?
So quite recently, the S&P Diversified Bank Index was 22% above its 22 or 23% above its 200-day moving average. I'd say that's like an athlete who sprinted a long way very quickly in a short period of time.
So it's a little ahead of itself.
Just may need to rest. It could need to pause, but I would say that the pattern that's in there is a very good technical setup. I'd also say with respect to the financials during the period when they were underperforming, I would ask myself and my counterparties on the sell side, are we in a bull market? And more often than not, you'd hear people say yes, but during that entire time, the S&P was up maybe 2 or 3%.
Pretty much range bound,
right.
Sideways.
So,
going
on. If you were in the FANG stocks, it was a bull market.
Right.
But I think if you were in the index, you would probably say it wasn't a bull market, but it wasn't a bear market either.
So just a range bound market. Look, we can't, from the lows in 09 to let's call it 13, market was up 200%+.
Yeah, right.
That's a lot of motion in a real short period of time. You have to eventually catch your breath. The market has to digest those gains.
I would think so.
So let me ask you a broader question, which you just made me think of. A lot of people say this market is long in the tooth because you have a nice run from 09 to 2016. That's 7 years. But I always learned secular bull markets don't begin until you make new highs above the previous highs. And we didn't see that happen until 2013. So first, do you look at the current situation as if we're in a secular bull market? And if we are, where would you date that to?
So I think we've been in there was a 666 low,
right,
in 2009. And up from 09 to now, the cumulative return would say time and price, you have been in a bull market. Mm-hmm. But you got most of that through, let's call it, the midpoint of 2014 or the autumn of 2014. And from the autumn of 2014 to now, you've really marked time by going sideways, although mm-hmm. it's been difficult and agita filled.
Right.
But I tend not to think of things secularly or cyclically. I tend to think of things, can I make money on the long side or can I make money on the short side? That's the way I tend to approach things because I don't want to be locked into a viewpoint.
That's really interesting. Over the past 2 years, has it been easier to make money on the long side or the short side or none of the above?
I think it's been equally difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's been a very difficult period. The market, in my mind, has been, the market is driven, ETFs drive stocks, stocks don't drive ETFs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the market on any given day can do just about anything because your algo is an aggressive buyer and then my algo follows your algo and my algo is an aggressive buyer. But it has been exceedingly difficult. And I think were it not for the Fed pinning the Fed funds rate where it is, perhaps the environment might be a little bit different.
Can you find another period in time in history that's comparable to this era, or is this truly unique?
I think it's truly unique because of the central bank backdrop. That's mm-hmm. that's my opinion.
That changes everything. We mentioned financials earlier. One of the things I know about your prior work, you used J.P. Morgan as a proxy for financials. I suspect that's because it goes back in history so long, but why one stock as opposed to a group of stocks?
So my former partner at Lehman Brothers, Steve Shobin, taught me about the importance of bellwethers. So over time, I've tried to find and define sector or market bellwethers. Now, for a long time, you'll recall this, people used General Motors. As General Motors went, so went the market. People used IBM for a long time. We, Steve Shobin and I, used General Electric. Uh-huh. And then as you went into the mid-2000s, Citigroup was the most important stock in the entire world, not just the most important stock in the S&P 500.
Well, that didn't work out too well.
Well, it did work out very well because when it peaked, then you knew it was over.
That was it.
Correct.
So it didn't work out well for Citigroup shareholders, but if you were paying attention to what Correct. Citi was doing.
It told you a lot about Citi, it told you a lot about the banks, and it told you a lot about the market. So it was an excellent bellwether.
When did Citi peak in the 2000s?
Well, it was peaking in 2006, 2007, right around the time when the financials as a percent of the S&P 500 got to about 22% on a relative market cap basis.
So when Citi rolled over, that was all she wrote.
It was sort of all she wrote.
Yeah, that's
and
really.
And so I think J.P. Morgan's a good bellwether, not only for financials, but for the market as a whole.
We've been speaking with John Roque. He is the technical strategist at Key Square Capital Management, backed by George Soros. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and check out all our podcast extras, where we keep the tape rolling and continue chatting about all things technical. Be sure and check out my daily column at BloombergView.com or follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. We love your feedback and comments. Be sure to write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Seeing what others have seen, but uncovering what others may not. Global research that helps you harness disruption. Voted top global research firm 5 years running. Merrill Lynch. Pierce Fenner and Smith Incorporated.
Welcome to the podcast. John, thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure, Barry.
You know, I've been a fan of yours for forever. I've been reading your stuff for a long time.
Thanks.
Which is not easy to get. Your stuff was always hard to track down.
Well, thanks.
I was always horse trading with other people. you get Roque? Get me that. What do you got? I'll give you this, you give me that. That, you know what happens on the...
I know.
So that went on all the time, and it was, we were never... a client. We were never big enough to play in the pond where you played. There were a couple of questions I didn't get to that I really want to get to before we start our usual podcast stuff. Why don't we jump right into the sports analogy since we were just talking about you. We were off air. We were talking about listening to baseball and drawing the metaphor between baseball on the radio versus financial television. You use a lot of sports analogies in your research. Now, is that because you're a sports junkie, or is that because there's a metaphorical parallel between sports and investing? Why all the baseball? In fact, just earlier we were talking about Soros's fund, like
playing for the Tar Heels or the Bruins. So I am a sports junkie, but I think that there are metaphorical examples that transfer seamlessly, and I'll give you one. So baseball people will tell you that Ted Williams is the greatest hitter of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book entitled The Science of Hitting. And one of the chapters in the book is called Hit According to Your Style.
Mm-hmm.
And he relates a story that was told to him, or an anecdote that was told to him by Rogers Hornsby. Roger with an S, right? Rogers Hornsby, who is the greatest right-handed hitter of all time. He's the last right-handed hitter to hit 400, and he actually averaged 400 over five seasons.
Really?
The only guy in Major League history to do that. He said to Williams that the single most important thing for a hitter was to get a good ball to hit. In other words, to swing at strikes. And I think the same thing can be applied to stocks. For example, you have to hit according to your style and not swing at stocks that are out of your strike zone. And I think that increases your chance of winning.
Makes perfect sense. You've seen the Buffett book that he recommended. So Warren Buffett recommended the Ted Williams book. And there's a graphic in the Ted Williams book.
Famous.
Of the strike zone.
Famous.
And he somehow figured out, so I think it was like seven balls across the top of the strike zone.
Yeah, because the plate is 17 inches across.
Right, so it's seven widths and 16 or 20.
Yeah, because he was about 6'3".
Right, so he figured out the exact strike zone.
Yep.
And then somehow calculated his hitting percentage
in
of each and every.
That's right.
Which, he was a quant before any money.
He was.
Years before Moneyball was ever conceived.
Right.
He applied probabilities.
That's right.
To hitting. Really, people don't understand how brilliant he was as a mathematical hitter, not just as a big dumb
jock. Yeah, he was way ahead of his time.
He was cerebral, and that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, I read the book when I was a player. I bought the book and tried to help my sons with it when they were players. And I tried to use some of his methods when I was coaching. And I would just tell my kids, if it's good, you got to be swinging. And if you're in certain counts, you need to be a hitter. You can't be taking pitches. And I know it's inappropriate or not, it's not the right way to say it, but to Little League players, but nobody ever went to the Hall of Fame being a good walker. You got there by being a good hitter.
So you play, where'd you play ball?
I played in high school. I played a little while in college, and I played some semi-pro baseball as well.
Oh, really? I was a pitcher. And I now have the torn rotator cuff.
So you're not throwing bat in practice?
No, not anymore. But I was accurate. I was fast. I had no breaking pitch, and that's why nothing after high school. Wait,
happens.
You're supposed to make the ball dry? I don't throw that way. I just throw it as hard as I can. So that's really – and I was deadly accurate. That was the best
threw
part
strikes,
of that.
Right.
Yeah, well, corner, little chin music, whatever you had to do. So you played semi-pro. That's great. How – what's amazing at that level, and we'll talk about a little math, is you get one more hit a week, and statistically, you're just so far ahead of everybody else.
That's correct.
The level of competition is really amazing.
Right. That's correct. If you strike out one less time a week, it's a big deal.
Huge. Just a huge deal. Have you read much of Michael Mauboussin's work on luck and skill?
So I have been able to sit in on some of his presentations. So the answer to that question is yes. I think he does some really good work about that.
The book, The Success Equation, Separating
yes.
Luck from Skill in yeah. Sports, Investing in Business. The irony is that the skill level is so high in professional sports that it turns out that luck matters a whole lot more than it does amongst amateurs.
Yeah, without a doubt. And they're playing a game in their head all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is why, and I said to my sons when during the playoffs in the World Series, if you really watch baseball closely, you'll watch that Major League Baseball players swing at pitches, not necessarily at strikes. And by that I mean you'll be watching a game and you'll see a guy take a pitch right down the middle, and you might say to yourself, how could he not swing at that? And the reason he wasn't swinging at it is because he wasn't guessing that on that pitch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he got a fastball, he may have been looking for a curveball. He got a curveball, he may have been looking for a fastball. So they're guessing, right? And they're playing a mental game, a calculation game, or a game of probability versus the pitcher. And that's the reason that, you know, at that level, that sometimes you would say, a younger guy, you'd say, you have to be swinging in that situation. And sometimes they're not swinging because they're not guessing at that pitch.
You know, the coach of the Giants, who departed a couple of years
ago.
Right, Tom Coughlin. I'm not a sports book fan, but he wrote a book called Earn the Right to Win. And he talks about, in the book, the research they were doing. All right, what is this opposition team? What do they do on you know, second and long? What do they do on third and short? What are they? And then every player would have to learn that. And some of the players really pushed back on it. And I'm trying to remember which, was it Strahan? It was one of their defensive backs used to complain about it all the time. And then years later, he's playing for another team, and it's a bowl game situation, and it's third and short, and he says, all right, what do these guys do on third and short? And he realizes, I don't have this information. Oh, my God, Coughlin was right. You need to have that prep. As big as a pain in the neck as it was a decided advantage. And what you're describing with the batters, very similar. If they know the pitcher, if they've studied him, they know their tendency. Yeah. People they're making a reasonable guess. All right, we're three and third and one. He tends to throw a breaking ball outside. I like to hit those.
Right.
It's really fascinating. The whole.
And I think the same thing applies to stocks. Right. You want to find a stock that fits your style. What's the tendency mm-hmm. of a stock to do something after it looks like it looks now?
Mm-hmm.
And so over time, you recognize that a pattern looks like it does now, and that usually is followed by some reaction. And that's because you tend to understand, or you tend to have seen so many of them over time. You
mm-hmm.
you tend to, I don't want to say foretell, but expect a certain result.
But that's why you look at hundreds of charts a night. You do that for 20 years, and eventually you really get a feel
right.
for, right, I've seen this pattern before, and I know what
right.
the what tends to happen here.
Exactly.
What other sports metaphors apply to markets and investing?
I really think baseball is about as good as there is.
Uh-huh.
We could go into basketball too, and I think there are a lot of basketball metaphors too.
Which, right.
And you could see now that teams really want to shoot three pointers. They know that you're getting 50% more per basket made than you would be mm-hmm. when you're shooting a two pointer. Right. They want, despite the fact that some of them might be low percentage shots, but the reward is so much greater.
But from the corner, it's a really high percentage shot,
because
and it's not that much further away.
It's a higher percentage shot because it's closer.
Right.
But conceivably, you're seeing less of the basket. It might be thought to be harder. When my father was a player, you know, when they still had laces on basketballs,
right.
he would have told you that's a poor percentage shot because you're not seeing the entire basket.
Well, you're not getting the same depth perception
because exactly right.
you just see the rim floating
exactly
out there.
Exactly right.
But if you have a touch and if you know where that is, that's your closest three-point shot you're going to make. And you see guys like Curry, they live in those corners.
Without a doubt. And I think...
As did Michael Jordan when he was shooting threes.
And I think, you know, sort of an appropriate football metaphor is that Brady and the Patriots are so successful not because he throws over the top to Gronkowski 30 yards down the field every time, but because he hits Edelman or Amendola, or when they had Wes Walker, he would hit them in the flat for 5 or 6 yards, move down the field, and then go over the top to Gronkowski,
right?
But to set it up so that you're taking short gains, then you have a lead.
It forces the backs to
right,
tighten up a little bit.
And then you have a lead, you know, the yardage is in your favor, and then you could go over the top to try to hit, you know, a mixed metaphor home run.
Right. Well, you know, that's the interesting thing about football is you're always trying to not just use each play to move the ball downfield, but each play subsequently sets up a ladder play. Are you throwing long and everybody's sitting back? Then they're giving you the shorter over the
chess,
middle.
It's checkers, not. Pardon me. It's chess, not checkers, as Denzel Washington said to Ethan Hawke in Training Day.
It's multiple steps
right.
down the road.
Chess, not checkers.
You know, there are some players that have the mental game, have the physical game, and then have all the tools out there to hit. When you look at New England, I mean, that's really just an embarrassment of riches for a quarterback who's smart, who has good field vision, and could really
run by
throw
a coach
the ball.
Who has a great system.
Right. So it's not a coincidence that those guys have been winning as much as they have been over the past couple of years. So give me a basketball metaphor. So it's the three-pointer, and what else? What else is a good basketball metaphor for investing? You know, I keep coming back
so
to...
I think a good one is that... So I watch a lot of basketball. I watch a lot of high school basketball. My former CYO coach is a very famous...
High school basketball?
I watch
really?
A lot of high school basketball because my former CYO coach, who's a friend of mine, is perhaps the, you know... He's a Westchester County Hall of Fame basketball coach, and he wins about 80% of his games.
Mm-hmm.
And I watch the games a lot, and I sometimes I see how they're playing or how they're winning. And I wonder, you know, whereas sort of hit according to your style in baseball or swing at strikes would be akin in basketball to making your free throws.
Right.
Right. Often in a high school game, the team that loses is the team that shot more poorly from the free throw line than their opponent.
Really? That's interesting.
So we can practice however many offensive sets or plays that are in my playbook. But if our team doesn't hit our free throws, regardless of how many offensive plays we have, we're probably not going to play that well.
What did you think about the, I don't remember if it was the high school, the college coach who... Every fourth down, he doesn't care. He goes
for it.
Yeah,
he goes for it.
I love the statistics on that.
Yeah, the statistics were great. I remember that.
Was that a Wall Street Journal article or a Times article?
I can't remember where it was printed, but I did read it, and he said, you know, my odds of success are
I got
better.
A third more plays than everybody else has.
Exactly.
Stop and think. A third more offensive plays if I'm going for it on fourth
down.
That's
right. I remember that story.
So the math behind that, the statistics are really quite fascinating. All right, so let's bring this back to technical analysis. I took the course with the great Ralph Acampora, and one of the things I remember from that course was Ralph saying, "Fundamentals tell you what to buy, technicals tell you when to buy." True, false? What do you think of that?
I think it's a pretty good tenet, but I'm also very fond of a tenet that was said by, I believe, Paul Tudor Jones. He said something to the effect of price moves first, fundamentals follow. Meaning that price moves and then a narrative develops around the price move. So I'm not dismissing what Ralph said. I think it's right, but I think Paul Tudor Jones has a little bit more, it's a wry observation and probably a little bit more cynical. It's sort of, you know, stocks moved sharply, especially financials, in the last week on the Trump election. And now people are trying to ascribe what will happen going forward.
Oh, they're going to deregulate.
For whatever reason. I'll leave those.
Frank, but it's always an after-the-fact
right, I'll leave
narrative.
Those reasons to the fundamental guys. But price moved, and then here's the reason price moved.
Right. Well, what good are you doing telling me after?
Right.
Well,
so,
why weren't you giving me this analysis beforehand?
So I think Paul Tudor Jones's line is pretty appropriate there.
I don't think it's cynical. I think it's human nature. We were just discussing this the other day that before the – so we can talk about the Clinton-Trump election. Before Trump won, the story was she has more money. She is a better get-out-the-vote ground game. They have better analytics. The Trump team is kind of just flinging darts and Hail Marys and what have you. And then afterwards, the narrative completely changed. Hey, their analytics turned out to be much better. They understood what was going on the ground in Wisconsin. And all these after-the-fact rationalizations, which, to be blunt, this election could have gone either way very easy. If the Access Hollywood tape doesn't come out, he steamrolls her. If the Comey letter doesn't take place in October, she probably beats it. Really, this could have easily broken either way. And yet, everybody wants to make these broad pronouncements after the fact. It's that same exact process. Oh, now that we know what happens, let's craft a narrative. Let's craft a narrative around it. I find that to be... absolutely fascinating. So a couple of other questions I didn't get to during the regular broadcast portion. We just touched on this very lightly. When I asked, you know, what attracted you to the technical side, was it the rigor of the discipline? Did it make sense logically? Was it some evidence or data that supported it? What made you say, oh, this really seems to be the way to go, and what I learned as an MBA student may not be the best way to buy and sell stocks?
I'm going to try to answer it like this. Let's say that I'm a real estate broker and I call you up and I say to you, hey, Barry, I got a place I'd like you to see. What's the first thing you say to me? You likely say to me, what does it look like? Where is it?
Right.
That's probably akin to saying, what is it? Can I look at the chart?
Right.
If, let's say I had a younger brother and you had a younger sister, and we would like them to sort of, you know, meet. Perhaps they can go out on a date, and we introduced the idea to each of them separately, what's the first thing that they would say to us? What does that person look like?
Right.
I think it's appropriate to think of it the same way with respect to charts. I mean, you have to look at something to be able to have an idea as to what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Billy Beane popularized Moneyball, but guys in the business will tell you that you still have to watch baseball players play. That's the reason teams pay scouts to go watch high school and college players. They have to see if they can play. It's sort of like getting a high school kid or a kid who played in a league that wasn't a strong league and he hit 600. Well, is that a legit 600 versus a kid who may have played in a league that was really tough who hit 4.25? I don't know. Maybe you need to see them play to be able to determine who's really the better player. So I think you have to look at what you're thinking about with respect to stocks, indexes, yields, currencies, commodities across the board.
I've asked a number of people, if you were only able to look at one thing, would you take a research report or would you take the chart? And invariably everybody says, even non-technicians, I have to see the chart.
I'm glad you said that because I think charts are the language of Wall Street. No matter who comes in to make a presentation, it could be an overview analyst from Hong Kong. It could be an overview analyst from Australia, wherever. It could be somebody here in town, one of the II-ranked overview people. When they come in, their presentation packages are chock full of charts. And so it may not be that they're technically oriented, but they are chart-oriented. And I really believe charts are the language of Wall Street.
So given how much computing power is at everybody's desk or even in your pocket on your phone, how does that change the world of technical analysis when everybody can access a chart anytime, anywhere? What does that do to the field?
I think it's actually made it stronger, right? I think it has made it more rigorous because people can check really quickly by looking at what you're looking at. Again, I'll go back to Steve Jobin's line, it's the singer, not the song, right? Mm-hmm. It's the interpretation that means more. But I think there's a greater degree of rigor with respect to technicals that wasn't there in the past when it was only, I don't want to say controlled, but let's say dominated by a few.
Right.
Because it was so hard to do these disciplines, right? Everything was pretty much done by hand.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's so widely dispersed that I think everybody has a flavor for it. And I think that's a very good thing for technical analysis.
That's interesting. So you referenced the impact of the Fed earlier, and the impact of algos. What has high frequency trading done to the way charts look and feel?
I actually think when Michael Lewis wrote the book about Brad Fukuyama,
Flash Boys.
I thought that was the smokescreen. Not that I'm not dismissing the book. I'm not dismissing high frequency trading, but I think high frequency trading was getting the blame for something that it shouldn't be getting the blame for.
Right.
I think the real risk to our business is in the ETF side of the business.
Really?
Yeah.
Explain. So I have a pet theory about bonds, but explain why you think ETFs are so problematic.
They're not problematic when we go up. They may be problematic when we go down. I think because people don't understand them. For example, if you call your broker and say, I'm going to buy an order of spiders, the SPY, you buy spiders. But you've created an unnatural bid for every stock in the S&P 500.
Sure, absolutely.
And I think most people who use those ETFs don't understand that. And I also think that if you have a portfolio of individual stocks and you add in an ETF, let's say the spider, your risk profile has changed because some of the stocks you already own are in the spider.
Right.
So your risk parameter is not what you thought it was. You've actually created sort of a derivative product and a leverage product by using a simple ETF.
So years ago, we had the S&P 500, we had the Dow Industrials. But you couldn't very easily trade them. You could go out and buy each of the components in them, but you couldn't just push a button and say, I want this, and it was done. So when you say ETFs have impacted this, it's not the index itself. It's that there's a trading vehicle
for the
index that's really easily accessible.
Right.
And I don't think a lot of people understand how ETFs are made and unmade.
I'm not certain I understand it.
Well, what little I know about it is normally something like maybe the S&P, the spiders aren't a good example, but you take another ETF or GLD for that matter, And it has some components. And most of the time when you're buying and selling it, you're just buying and selling that component. There are ARBs who will basically identify when it gets out of whack with the underlying holdings and buy this and sell that in order to bring it into appropriate balance. But sometimes the underwriter is making more units when the demand is overwhelming. We saw that with GLD on the way up. It wasn't a finite matter of GLD shares. They were actually making more as the demand had blown up from, let's call it 05 to 2010. And then as that unwinds on the way down, they start taking those units apart and selling the actual gold futures or whatever
paper the underlying they're using. Is right.
Yeah. It's not just this is a closed-end fund that's trading based on supply and demand. There are components that go into it.
Yeah, no doubt, which is why I think it's very hard to understand those things.
So it's okay on the upside, it's a problem on the downside?
Well,
Is that the balance of risk?
I don't think anybody understands, and I'm at the forefront of not understanding what it could mean on the downside. We haven't seen it. But I do recall, so it wasn't August 15, it would probably have been August 2014, where we were down really sharply over a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some dislocation with respect to ETFs, and ETFs that were sort of supposed to be more stable were mm-hmm. marked down tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that was a preview of what could happen. But again, I don't think I can take a guess as to what it could look like. It might be fine. It might be well contained. It might not be. I don't know.
I mean, there was still plenty of ETFs. Not that there was nearly as much money in them, but 08, 09, there were the spiders, the Qs, the diamonds.
But I think the
there's active, trillions more
yeah,
today.
Yeah, the active versus passive now is really, you know, the ratio has shifted, and the rate of change for assets going into passive versus assets going into active has really benefits the passive mm-hmm. side of the business, of which the ETFs are
Bill McNabb of Vanguard says we look at this wrong, that it's not active versus passive, it's expensive versus
that's
cheap.
That's fine too.
But that's
we could characterize it like that too.
Right?
Yeah,
he believes that's what's been driving.
Well,
this.
Sometimes expensive versus cheap, and then cheap becomes expensive.
Right. That certainly is a possibility, assuming there's no risk management in a downside move, and ETFs get shellacked. So there were one or two other questions I wanted to go over. And you implied this, but I want to explore a little more. The advancement of technology, what has this done for technicals? What does this mean to trading in the market?
I think the effect on technical analysis is incalculable.
Really?
The Bloomberg terminals, what you can do on the Bloomberg terminals.
It's insane. It's totally insane. We our office laughs. It's like, I feel like we're barely scratching
the
surface.
To give you an idea. So the other day, I did a relative ratio of a group of Macau gaming stocks.
Right.
To Paddy Power, which is the Ireland-based,
right.
London-traded online betting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 10 years ago, I couldn't have done that.
Right.
20 years ago, it was inconceivable. And if you did it, you had to do a calculator if you had one, or a spreadsheet if you had a Lotus right. 1-2-3. And then I can do it with a handful of keystrokes on Bloomberg.
It's crazy.
Yeah, that's amazing. Amazing.
So what does this do to the process of learning how to chart? And what does it do to the market having all this technical horsepower?
Well, it's another reason that I think it's more appropriate for me to try to stick with longer term trends mm-hmm. rather than trying to be a trader, because I can't figure that I'm going to be any better than any machine.
Right. And you and John Henry.
Yeah. I can't figure that I'm going to be any better than somebody who is a trader. I'm not a trader. I'm an analyst.
Right.
And so I think my strength is trying to stick with trend rather than trying to, be able to trade better than somebody who's doing it every single minute they're in their chair.
So you referenced trend earlier. Let's talk about trend as opposed to patterns and mean reversion. What makes trend so significant?
Because I think when you have the trend right, you're bailed out of your mistakes.
When you have the trend right. Well, what are the mistakes when you have the trend right?
Sometimes you overthink your positions. I'll use you as my example. Let's say you bought something today.
Mm-hmm.
Invariably, you come in on Monday morning, you're questioning yourself whether or not you should have bought that. Tuesday, you're doing the same thing. And you do that every single day that you own that item.
Right.
Until you get rid of it. But sometimes our best decisions are made stepping away from the screen or the terminal, whatever you want to say, and trying to conceive of that item within its trend. And you might say, okay, I get it. That stock might have some difficulties because I might have not had the best entry point.
Right.
But overall, it is in an uptrend. And because it's in an uptrend, I'm going to give that stock the benefit of the doubt on any pullback. Now, you might have to set up a risk parameter for yourself that says, okay, I know it's in an uptrend, but if it breaks some percentage retracement level, I don't care what that trend says. I have to reduce my position because it impacts the rest of my portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when an item is in an uptrend and you are long that item, it deserves the benefit of the doubt, meaning that, you know, it can get knocked around a little bit, but the trend is not broken.
And before I get to my favorite questions, I would be remiss if I did not ask you, you were at Lehman Brothers in the middle of the 90s. That had to be a hopping place at that time. What was that like?
It was a great place. I worked with a guy named Steve Chauvin. I've mentioned his name a few times today. He was exceedingly patient and kind with me. He answered millions of my questions. He still is one of the quippiest guys in the business.
Quippiest.
Quippiest. I mean, he's never at a loss for a quippy comeback. And you just laugh because he was just so darn fast with them. Lehman was a great place. He was a great place. I just had a chance to be the technical guy at Arnhold and S. Bleichroeder, and I thought it was a chance to, you know, sort of be...
That's why you jumped. You went from one of many to
the
guy.
It wasn't because of any... You know, I was displeased on the other side. I just said, you know, here's an opportunity for myself.
I asked because Jeff DeGraff referenced, who was Lehman's chief technical
guy. He replaced me at Lehman Brothers.
Oh, really? Oh, that's hilarious. He said, he goes, I assure you it's dumb luck, but he handed his resignation in the day of the all-time high in Lehman Brothers.
Pretty good timing.
Yeah, so to set up Ren Macro.
Yeah.
So I go, that's how you know a guy's a good technician, is he quits a publicly traded company, and that marks the high of the day. All right, so let's jump to my favorite questions I ask all my guests. You told us about your background. You said you got an MBA from what is now Gabelli School of Management, but it's at Fordham. Did you do anything between school and Wall Street, or you went right from college, right from grad school to finance?
That's right. Yeah, right
straight in.
Yeah, nothing in between.
And obviously, I'm going to ask you who your early mentors are. Steve Chauvin is going to be one of them.
Right. My very first boss was a guy named Tom McKee. He was a great boss. He taught me how to do my job responsibly.
Uh-huh.
And then I worked for Ken Safian at Safian Investment Research, and he gave me a lot of freedom to do a lot of things for him, and it was a great learning experience. Steve Chauvin, I can't say enough about. I worked for a guy named Jeff Collier and John Arnhold Arnhold and S. Bleichroeder, and both were gentlemen to me. And while at Soros Fund Management, I worked for Robert Soros, who was a gentleman to me as well, a guy who was always open to technicals and looking at markets and charts. And I've been fortunate for the last 5 years to work for a guy named Scott Besson, who encourages imaginative thinking. He's always interested in listening to an idea. He's really pragmatic, and he's instilled confidence because he's allowed me the freedom to make a mistake. And I don't want to dismiss that point. You know, we don't want to make mistakes, but you make them.
It's the nature of the business. If you're a 400 hitter, you're a rock star.
Right, and you're still making out 6 out of 10 times. So he understands the mistake part of the business, thankfully for me, and I'm lucky to be a part of Key Square and with him.
So what other investors influenced how you approach markets and investing?
So I've tried to listen to anything or read anything that these people have said, and some of them I worked with and for. So Steve Chauvin, Scott Besson, Howard Marks, who is a value guy, and anything he's ever written, I've tried to read, you know, his memos when they are, you know,
every quarter.
Right. Stan Druckenmiller, George Soros, Paul Jones, and I really appreciate anything Nassim Taleb has to say. I really like his common sense sort of contrary approach to the business and to the thinking in the business.
Very interesting. Let you mention reading. Let's talk about some books. What are some of your favorite books, be they fiction, nonfiction, investing, or otherwise?
Okay, so I really liked a book about the Comanches called The Empire of the Summer Moon, which was really, really a fantastic book.
Really?
Yeah, just great. I really liked that a lot. Really liked it a lot. With respect to market stuff, Market Wizards by Jack Schwager, I think is a required reading. More Money Than God. I really liked The Creature from Jekyll Island, which is by Edward Griffin. That was about the start of the Federal Reserve.
Right.
One of my favorites of all time is The Lords of Finance by Liaquat Ahmed. And the subtitle of the book is The Bankers Who Broke the World, which I think is as good as it gets. Manias, Panics, and Crashes by Charles Kindleberger. Mm-hmm. Shut Up and Deal by Jesse May. I'm a big sports book guy as well. I recently read a biography about Ty Cobb, which sort of changed the way people originally thought about Cobb.
He was supposed to be really hard charging, spikes out, no fooling around type of guy.
He played really hard, and I'd say back then it was sort of kill or be killed in baseball. I know I'm making too much of it, but there was no fraternizing.
Uh-huh.
But he was thought to have been a bad guy. I don't necessarily think that he was a bad guy, and this new biography would say that he wasn't.
A newer and gentler Ty Cobb.
Yeah, something like that.
So since you've joined finance all those years ago, what has changed? What do you think is the most significant changes in the industry over the past 25 years?
When we got into the business, there was a tremendous broker-client component to the business, which to a great degree doesn't exist now. It's more of an asset gathering component, where by then it was more transactional.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember a lot of guys that I knew in the business, they started their career making cold calls. I don't know.
Is it better or worse, this change? Is that a better structure, or do you lose something?
I think what's changed is that it was easier then to come up with some sort of sentiment read for the market. I think it's harder now.
Uh-huh.
And with the individual investor in an asset gather, having been asset gathered rather than via the old broker method, I think it's harder to figure things out in that regard. But it's a natural evolution. I think the advent and ubiquity of ETFs, the continued involvement of central bankers, the evolution of central bankers from behind-the-scenes practitioners of the Hippocratic Oath to virtual financial celebrities, those are all tremendous changes over the last 25
financial
years.
Financial celebrities.
Yeah, that's the way I tend to think of them.
Is that a bad thing or a good thing? Or does it depend on the celebrity?
I think that there's a major shift occurring where investors are moving away from the belief of the omniscience of central bankers.
Uh-huh.
In fact, in my mind, that has been a bubble in its own right. And I think that we are realizing that central bankers are far from omniscient.
Well, everybody remembers Greenspan as the maestro, and he left as chairman. And then it didn't take all that long for that reputation to really unwind.
Right.
The financial crisis certainly didn't
right.
help his reputation.
Right.
The guy who looked like he was never wrong, suddenly, maybe this guy was never right. He just got a little lucky. And I'm amazed that people put so much faith in central bankers after the guy was lit. I mean, I remember the CNBC briefcase cam.
Correct.
Like, how thick or thin is his briefcase? And that's whether he'll raise or tighten. That's how tightly
right.
people track that. I don't think anybody holds bankers, at least with the same, belief that they know all the answers. They're certainly important, but did Greenspan break the spell for that?
I think we're in an environment where people are looking at, for lack of a better phrase, the political financial elite in a different light than they had in prior cycles. I think so many of their missteps are well categorized or delineated,
right?
And that information is well dispersed, whereby perhaps it may have only been in prior cycles people in our business who are aware of who the head of the central bank was.
Right. The public knows that not only does the public know who the head of the central bank is, they know there's a central bank. You go back 20 years, they had no clue there was such a thing.
Every day you turn around, there's another central banker
speaking somewhere, being covered.
I think that they're ubiquitous, both for their presence and their comments. And I think that they'll run through their cycle just like every other item runs through a cycle.
You mentioned Malaby's More Money Than God. Have you gotten around to his new tome on Greenspan?
I have not.
I have the book. I haven't even cracked it open yet. I'm really curious because my head of research, Mike Batnick, like you, loved More Money Than God. And that's another book I haven't gotten. I actually started reading it right after I finished reading something else. And they were so similar in who they looked at. And I said, you know, I'm going to put this aside a little bit and come back to it. But I know a number of people who just love that book, think it's great.
I thought it was terrific.
Really? So I'm going to move that up in my queue. So you mentioned you played ball in school. What do you do to relax outside of the office? What do you do to stay mentally and physically fit so you can do your job?
Listen, like a lot of guys, I like to go to the gym. I like to be active. I like to spend a little time walking down at the Bronx Riviera, which is otherwise known as Orchard Beach.
Bronx Riviera.
So things like that.
Are you in Bronxville? Where do you live?
I'm a Westchester guy, but listen, driving down to Orchard Beach from Lower Westchester is an very easy thing to do.
That's pretty interesting. So you've been mentored along in your career. What sort of advice would you give a recent college grad or a millennial who is just starting their career and said, hey, John, I'm thinking about going into technicals. What would you say to them?
I'd offer no advice, but I'd offer some suggestions.
Okay.
I'd say listen intensely.
Mm-hmm.
Ask a ton of questions and read everything you can.
Listen intensely, ask lots of questions.
And read just about anything you can, not only finance, because I think sometimes your best thinking about finance is when you're not thinking about finance.
Sure.
It could be because you're reading a biography about Billy Martin. It could be because you're reading about the Comanches and Empire of the Summer Moon. It could be because you're reading Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry. I don't know, but I think you should read as much as you can.
That is not an uncommon theme. A number of people who have passed through these doors, billionaires, fund managers, Nobel Prize winners, have all said the same thing, that the two themes that come up over and over again, reading, and you gotta be in a position to get lucky, because a little luck goes a long way. And our last question, what is it that you know about investing in technicals today that you wish you knew 25 years ago?
I mean, everything. I mean, I wish I knew everything then that I know now, and I haven't learned anything, I think, in the last 10 years.
Why? Say that again.
Because I wish I knew then what I know now, but I feel like even though I've picked up a lot in the last 10 years, there's still so much to learn. And I think every single day you go to work, you know, juiced, not only because you want to win, but because it's a learning environment. It's an active learning environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a lucky environment to be in.
That's a really interesting answer. John, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. We have been speaking with John Roque. He is Managing Director and Technical Analyst at Key Square Capital Partners. Is that
Capital
right?
Capital Management.
Key Square Capital Management. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and look up an inch or down an inch on Apple iTunes, and you could see any of the other 100 and let's call it 12 previous podcasts we've done. We enjoy your comments and feedback. Be sure to write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. I would be remiss if I did not thank Charlie Vollmer, my engineer, Taylor Riggs, our booker, and Michael Batnick, who is the head of research for us. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon. Named the most innovative investment bank for climate change and sustainability by The Banker. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, North America. Member FDIC.